Welcome everyone to another episode of For the Love of Cinema. My name is Grayson Maxwell. Today I'm joined by you want to say your name, Nick?
Hey everyone, it's Nick Morris.
Nick Morris in the well, not really in the flesh. It's in the flesh, but you are calling in remotely from you're in Pennsylvania right now, right? You're not in West Virginia anymore.
I'm in PA.
PA, how is PA treating you, man?
You know what? It's okay. It rained a little bit. My basement got flooded. Cool. It's whatever.
That's not good.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. It wasn't cool at all, actually.
Well, I'm sorry that happened to you, man. That sucks.
It's quite alright.
Well, I mean, it's not alright, but we will make do.
Yeah, I'll fix it. I'll get to it.
Alright. Nick, so, we have a movie that came out recently we want to talk about. War... Mm-hmm. For Planet of the Apes, Nick, give me your just before we hop into it, give me your overarching. What do you want to say about it?
You know what? I think it was a overall, it was a good movie. There were definitely some parts where I felt emotionally invested, and I'm not gonna lie, it wasn't a tearjerker. I will say that, but I felt one lonely tear fall down my face. At a moment in the movie, and it really got me.
Well, that's good.
I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of Planet of the Apes.
I gotta say I am. I wasn't, but before this movie, I wasn't. Mm-hmm. I gotta admit, I didn't expect to like it as much as I did. But we will get into that first. Let's see what the box office did. I'm actually a little interested to see how things performed this weekend. It was an interesting weekend because. War for Planet of the Apes and Dunkirk were the top ones.
Oh yeah, of course.
And Spider-Man was up there. But here's how we did. So Dunkirk was number one this week, which is no surprise. Christopher Nolan, I think James Cameron has some competition for King of the World.
Oh yeah.
Both are two of my favorite directors. But Dunkirk, a little movie you may have heard of, $150 million budget. Worldwide has done 105 so far. You know, for Nolan, I don't think that's like shattering numbers, but I think it's pretty good. I mean, anything over 100 million, I'm sure opening weekend, any studio is certainly okay with.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, I mean, he's putting up pretty good numbers.
He always does. To me, it's like he's a safe bet. Like, I mean, most of my directors I like are pretty safe bets, and he's certainly one of them. Number two this week. Number two this week, and it's only been out 1 week, Girls Trip.
Really?
$19 million budget, it's so far brought in $30 million domestically. That's got, that's actually a pretty high number, I think, but look at the cast here. We have Jada Pinkett Smith, Queen Latifah, yeah. Regina Hall, and Lorenz Tate. I think, I mean, everyone knows all the, maybe Lorenz Tate, might be the guy in there that a lot of people don't know. He's been in a lot of comedies. He was in a movie with Vin Diesel, A Man Apart. I think he's the one that people know the least in there, but I've really... but everyone else in that cast, people seem to know. So maybe that's why it's putting up such good numbers for a comedy. But that's no... Yeah, it's good.
I heard this like the first time in 20 years that Jada Pinkett and... Jada Pinkett Smith and...
Who? No? Queen Latifah? Regina Hall?
Queen Latifah, yeah. It's their first time in, 20 years that they're back on the screen together?
Well, what were they on the screen together first with? That was...
Set It Off, or...
Oh, my goodness, you're right. I completely forgot about that. I never would have... Yeah, Set It Off. Jeez Louise.
Yeah, right?
That's kind of cool, though. So, I mean, that's Girls Trip. Good numbers. Good, solid numbers. Spider-Man Homecoming, number three this week. Number two last week. I'm sorry. $175 million budget. So far has brought in $571 million worldwide. That's a good number.
That's awesome.
I'm happy that Spider-Man is doing well. I really... No, I gave some lists last week about how I I like Andrew Garfield as the best Spider-Man, but I think Tobey Maguire's Spider-Man 2 is the best Spider-Man movie so far. So,
I really enjoyed Homecoming.
You know what? Give us a 30-second review by Nick about Spider-Man Homecoming. Did you like it? Did you not like it?
Well, I thought it was very funny. I mean, well, it had its moment. It wasn't a comedy, obviously, but it had its comedic moments. The guy in the chair? that guy was an absolute blast. It was a decent love interest, and I had no idea about the dad. You know, that was crazy finding that out. But overall, I think the movie was good. And when I was in the theater, people were like, "Oh, I didn't know this was another Iron Man movie," because Tony Stark was in it a good bit. But I mean, I think he kind of has to be, since Spider-Man is kind of his Padawan. You know what I mean?
I enjoy the movies being connected more and more. Within the bubble that is Marvel, I like the movies when they're not being, I mean, I think those movies are pretty good. Within the Marvel sphere, I think they're good. Within the good movie sphere, you know, some of the best movies in history, I don't think they rank, nor will they ever rank, in some of the best.
Yeah.
But I mean, they're all pretty solid movies. And again, with in context of, you know, it's a Marvel movie or it's a superhero movie, they're pretty good.
Yeah.
So Spider-Man's pulling in some solid numbers. War for Planet of the Apes, number 4 this week, number 1 last week. Boy, oh boy, this movie is $150 million budget, $174 million worldwide. That's not bad.
Yeah, it's not bad. I mean, at least they're making their money back, you know? And I'm sure it will continue to grow, obviously.
Yeah, it's... I have some interesting numbers. We'll get into it when we get into the discussion about what Rise for Planet of the Apes did and what Dawn for Planet of the Apes did, their respective budgets and then their box office. But we can get into that in a little bit. Valerian, A City of 1,000 Planets. Oh, geez. Listen to this budget. This is going to blow your mind. $209.184 million budget. That's what it says. And so far has domestically pulled $17 million.
Oh, God.
Ah, Valerian. I've been saying it for weeks. It was going to come in and go out like a whimper. Jeez. Luc Besson, my God. I don't think you're ever going to direct a movie again.
They've been working on that movie for, 10 years or something like that?
I don't know. I mean,
probably not 10 years, but...
I hope that movie has a long run. I hope people, 6 weeks from now, discover it, and that movie has a long run, because it's not doing well right now. Jeez.
And you know what? It was either, this week, it was either my choice of Dunkirk or Valerian.
You made the right choice. I'm sure you watched Dunkirk, right?
Yes, I did. I made the right choice.
Yes, you absolutely made the right choice. And director and movie, I think. I think, what's so weird about Valerian is it's so oddly positioned. It was coming out against such big, heavy hitters. I don't know. I didn't, before I heard the term, or the movie Valerian and the City of 1,000 Planets, I never even knew that property existed. So
exactly. I believe it was a graphic novel or something like that.
Oh, that I don't know and I can't confirm, but that's very interesting. I mean, that is such a huge budget for such a low return. That's like Waterworld numbers, man. That's bad.
Oh, God.
I know. I will without a doubt. See, now I'm intrigued because I have to watch it to see why people aren't watching it. But that's, you know.
Yeah.
Number 6 this week, number 3 last week. Despicable Me, still pulling in the numbers. $80 million budget right now. Worldwide, $727 million. That's climbing the charts. Jeez.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't expect that movie to do nearly as well as it's done. Only because it's the third one in. It's just people start to get sick of them after.
Exactly.
That's a very respectable number. Number 7 this week, number 4 last week, Baby Driver. Edgar Wright's either his masterpiece or certainly his second best.
Oh, yeah.
$34 million budget has brought in so far worldwide, $118 million. Boy, he has to be happy with that. Nick, what do you think about Baby Driver?
I loved it. The action, the driving, my God. I,
Those were some impressive driving shots. And as long as they were, in some of the shots that didn't have takes or didn't like cut, boy, especially the opening shot where he's walking with the coffee, and he's like zipping in and out of people and out of door. Like that's just it's really cool to see that.
Perfectly intertwined.
I loved it. Loved it. The big sick, number 8 this week, number 5 last week. No budget given. 24 million domestic plus 146,000 foreign, so altogether 24,686,000. That's not terrible. There's no budget given, so I'm worried about that. But otherwise, that's not terrible.
My thought on the big sick, I haven't seen it yet, and I really wanted to because I heard it was pretty funny. I couldn't imagine it being high. You know what I mean? I mean, I'm sure it's up in the millions, but I couldn't imagine them spending too much money on that movie. You know what I mean?
Well, I follow a lot of celebrities in Twitter, and I notice a lot of people congratulating on how good The Big Sick is. Or weeks ago when it was released, you know, before it was released to the public, I think Elijah Wood tweeted it out, someone else tweeted. But I mean, for a movie to be like good, I would think for people like huge celebrities to tweet, then the movie must be pretty good. I don't think they want to be wrong about that. But
Very true.
That definitely is one that I think I will see if I have the time. But right now I'm so busy right now. Number 9, Wonder Woman still kicking. She's still wonderful. $149 million. That's an odd. Like I don't know why they just didn't go to $150 million. It's weird. So far, has brought in $779 million. Wonder Woman: The Chris Pine Tale.
Wow. Yeah.
The almost Steve Trevor movie. I'm obsessed with that arc. I think about that arc all the time. How it just was never done. How angry I am that arc was never finished. But I don't know. What do you think of Wonder Woman? Did you see it?
Yes, I did. Yeah. And I thought about going to see it again. but I haven't. I don't know. It's been a couple weeks since I've seen it, but I did enjoy the movie, and the conversation we had a couple weeks ago where we were wondering if it's going to save the, you know, DC cinematic universe, I thought it did a pretty good job in pointing it towards the right direction, you know? But, I don't know, I guess we'll see with Justice League and all that coming out.
Yeah, this is, you know, Marvel's had a pretty big run, but this is the next year or two is going to be pretty big for DC. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping good things because as fearful as I am of all of these movies intermingling with each other and just, you know, getting so intimately intertwined is a lot of, I know some, a lot of my favorite gaming franchises, they, as they go on, as different chapters come out for there's one franchise I love, the Metal Gear franchise. Every time,
oh, yeah.
Every time a new chapter comes out, it's in a different part of the timeline, and it's so perfectly woven that it's almost completely unbelievable in the way. Cause, I mean, things just don't happen like that. But
exactly,
you know, we'll see. I mean, Wonder Woman was a good, a very good, very capable DC movie. That's the movie that DC has been asking for a long time. So, and rounding out the top 10, Wish Upon, that horror movie. $12 million budget so far has made $10 million worldwide. I don't think anyone's caring about that one anymore. Ryan Felipe, why did you choose that job? Why did you make that choice? That's your box office releases this week. Dunkirk came out. Valerian, City of a Thousand Planets. Girls Trip. The July 28th, which is next Friday, I do believe. It is next Friday. July 28th, we have Emoji Movie, Atomic Blonde. And August 4th, I think the best movie of the summer, Dark Tower. And then we also have Detroit. August 11th, Annabelle Creation and The Glass Castle. August 18th is The Hitman's Bodyguard. We got Samuel L. We got Ryan Reynolds doing their thing. And then the 25th of August, when everyone is probably back in school, not a lot going on, Polaroid and All Saints. Predictions are... predictions are Dunkirk will do great, and it has. Valerian won't do anything, and it hasn't. Atomic Blonde will do okay. We'll see that. We'll see that in a few weeks. Dark Tower in Detroit will make tons. Annabelle. I don't even think anyone cares about Annabelle anymore. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but that's. We'll see.
It might not
Because there's a lot of movies coming out in October that people are excited for, but I don't know if Annabelle is. If you'll notice, Annabelle's not in, and it's a horror thriller, but it's not in October. So I mean, and Annabelle comes out August 11th. Like, it's just odd time for that kind of movie, I think. But
that's crazy.
Hitman's Bodyguard will do okay, and Polaroid won't do anything at all. All Saints won't do anything. But that's just, again, those are predictions. I hope I'm wrong.
I think you're right on some on The Dark Tower, obviously. Atomic Blonde. I'm kind of excited for that.
I mean, who isn't? But, seeing Charlize Theron just kicking some ass?
Yeah. And, I mean, what, some people are calling it, like, the new female James Bond, but, hey, I wouldn't put that on her like that. I mean, let her be her own thing, you know, let her kick ass in her own way.
Well, everyone's looking for that. Everyone's looking for that. Everyone's looking for that in as far as actors and actresses go. To me, I can't understand why Daniel Craig doesn't want to do it anymore. Why? That's a solid gold franchise, and he's a great actor. I mean, he is to me right now. He is Bond. He is what Bond always should have been. He's a ruthless killer. He's a ladies' man. He's a killer. He's, you know, that is Bond to me. But something that Pierce may have been a ladies' man, but he wasn't a ruthless killer. So that's just, you know, all there is to it. But all right, current events. John Hurd passed away, and I'm saying this as that's not the Titan that recently passed, but John Hurd, I know him from Home Alone, Jack and Bobby, and Prison Break. That's what I know him from. Big fan of, not a huge fan of John Hurd, only because, like, I don't think he ever made, you know, A-list, but I mean, he's certainly a recognizable name. Huge loss. He's in so many things. I was looking over it. He was in tons of TV. So, I mean, John Hurd, current event, he has passed away. George Romero has passed. What do you think about that, Nick?
I was very sad about that, just because I remember the first time I ever watched Night of the Living Dead, and I was amazed. I think I was in middle school, first time I ever heard about this movie, and it was shot in southwestern PA. Near Pittsburgh, I believe, somewhere around there, near Cranberry, maybe. The cemetery scene, at least. But I don't know. I was a little shocked. Obviously, everyone was. I was a little hurt, you know.
Yeah, I think that was a big shock for a lot of people. A lot of people love the George Romero zombie movies, and you know exactly what you're getting when you're going into one. So that'll be interesting to see what happens now that he's no longer making them.
Yeah.
Other filmmakers, I'm sure, will take up the mantle, certainly, but, you know, he's the father of that, so that's always been interesting. And I like to think about the original Night of the Living Dead. I tend to watch from time to time when it's on TV, especially when I'm home. The movie was shot on a reasonably low budget, and it was terrifying for its time, so...
Mm-hmm.
And it was shot in Pennsylvania, as you said. She shot a lot of stuff in Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah. And I think you probably notched on this a little bit ago. He made it. He made the zombie franchise, you know? He was it.
Yeah, he's the father. He's king.
So many people.
He's king of the zombie. You know, he's the king zombie.
Yeah.
George Romero, farewell, my friend. It's a heavy loss for all of us, especially people who love the horror genre, that like love those low budget. Not that his movies are ever always low budget, but zombie movies can have a certain amount of cheese to them, and he certainly was the creator of all that. And another thing I have written down here: Creed 2, I think is interesting. Ryan Coogler is doing this one as well, and Ivan Drago is going to fight Creed's son, if I read that right. And the script is by Sylvester Stallone. So we're getting a Creed 2. The first Creed came out, actually was well received, made all kinds of money.
Did you see the Creed, the original Creed? First one?
You mean like 2 years ago, first one? Or like Apollo Creed?
Yeah, I said
original. But yeah. Yeah, I liked it. I wasn't as crazy about it as a lot of people, but I liked it. It was a good movie. So,
I didn't see it when it first came out, but a couple months later, you know, I give two thumbs up to Michael B. Jordan's role. He did fantastic, I think.
Not a lot of people. I have a friend of mine back home who said that that was his favorite movie of 2015. Yeah, that was his favorite movie of 2015, and it kind of stunned me for a minute. Cause I'm like, wait a minute. I'm like, okay, well, after about 15 seconds of being shot, I can see that. Yeah. I mean, it's, well, I used the wrong word. Favorite and best. He said it's the best movie of 2015, and that's what I was so shocked by. But I mean, I can see that. It's certainly a good movie. I like how, you know, to be honest, I like Sylvester Stallone going back to that franchise and kind of making it fresh again with Apollo Creed's son. Now, if you remember in Rocky IV was the one where Rocky was trying to retire. He was working with Apollo Creed, and Apollo Creed was beaten to death in the ring by Ivan Drago, the Russian played by, what's his name? Dolph Lundgren.
Yeah.
So this is certainly going to be an emotional movie, I think.
Are they really bringing Dolph Lundgren?
Is he being Ivan Drago?
Yeah.
I didn't write that down. I would have said yes, but I can't confirm that because I didn't write it down. I don't know why I didn't write that down, but
I hope. My God.
I would imagine he's been in those Expendables. He's still a monster. I mean, he's still a beast.
Yeah. Oh yeah, definitely.
And when it's Grayson, there's always something about Christopher Nolan and or James Cameron. There has to be. Nolan hates Netflix. He hates that it, and I'm putting in air quotes right now because this is what he said, cuts out the movie theater experience. And this is a quote from Christopher Nolan. Netflix has a bizarre aversion to supporting theatrical films. They have this mindless policy of everything having to be simultaneously streamed and released, which is obviously an untenable model for theatrical presentation. So they're not even getting in the game, and I think they're missing a huge opportunity. Now, that was Nolan on Netflix versus movies in theaters. Now, as you know, as we move into the age of streaming, when cars no longer have cassette tapes or CD players, it's all, you have to plug your phone in, or you have to play it digitally, or for some way, we're moving away from the physical, you know, you're holding a physical copy of something in your hand, like a CD or a movie, and everything's going to streaming, and Netflix has certainly been a huge player in that.
Oh, yeah.
You'd be hard-pressed to find someone that doesn't have Netflix these days. I don't come across them often, and that's how a lot of people watch shows. That's how a lot of people binge shows. And as a further point, Netflix releases the things they make in seasons. They don't even put them up when the episode's done. They release entire seasons at a time. So
exactly.
That's how Netflix wants you to watch things. They want you to binge. I can see where Nolan would be in contention with that. When you go to watch a movie, what you're paying for is the phenomenal sound. You're paying for the wonderful picture that you can't get in the consumer world. Theaters are always ahead. Well, maybe not a theater that hasn't been updated in, you know, decades, but theaters are always way ahead of consumer technology. You're paying the ticket for the watching that particular movie in the best setting in that theater can offer you. And I've always thought that a lot of people say that, you know, $15 too much for a movie. But though I do tend to agree with that, I'm not sure I agree with, is it too much for that particular movie? Probably yes. But is it fair for the sound quality you're getting and the picture quality? Probably. I mean, it's a fair trade.
I will say I do agree with Nolan and you from what you're saying, because there are some movies that you definitely should go see in theaters. And I know, I'll say this, Dunkirk, it came out in 70mm, I believe, in some places that have that. And I feel like I cheated myself a little bit because I didn't see it in 70mm, but I'm sure it's fantastic. It's probably better than the way I watched it.
No, yeah, 70 millimeter is definitely the way to watch that movie, especially because Nolan does not make I'm laughing. Nolan does not make small movies.
Oh, yeah.
Production value, production value, production value, production value, budget. That's the Nolan way. I have the wonderful fortune of I was on Dark Knight Rises. I traveled in the United States with them, and boy, that man is. I sure hope he one day becomes really one of the greats. I think he's on his way, and I don't think he's there yet. I said all the time, I'm hard on him because I love everything he does. There's not one movie he's made that I don't love. That's not that I haven't personally paid for on iTunes and downloaded on my phone. Now it's interesting that we just read that quote about Netflix versus theater experience, but I mean, I watch movies on my phone from time to time, and that is absolutely not the way to watch movies. Although the picture quality is pretty good on screen that small for something like I have the iPhone that's it's got a very good screen, the iPhone 6S. The picture quality is pretty good, but you definitely don't want to watch it on that small of a phone ever. That's foolish. And he goes on further to say, Nolan, this is going to be, I'm reading this next quote. This is from Nolan directly. I think the investment that Netflix is putting into interesting filmmakers and interesting projects would be more admirable if it weren't being used as some kind of bizarre leverage against shutting down theaters. It's so pointless, I don't really get it. Now, that was Nolan talking on Netflix's role versus the way movies are supposed to be watched. I think he's right. It's never going to put movies theaters out of business. They will adjust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One day, ticket prices will go down. As a matter of fact, this listener not going to know this, but Roger and myself and you were on the way to one of the episodes, we're talking about how there's one theater popped up. Where did that theater pop up that's charging literally almost half the ticket price?
I have no idea, but I do remember you talking about it. I've actually thought a couple times about that. And it's brilliant what they did, undercutting, because there was not really undercutting, but I mean they really were undercutting their ticket sales versus the theater down the street. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And I mean, it worked. You know, they brought in more customers, I'm sure.
Well, people aren't dumb. I mean, people will go to where they get the most value of their buck, especially at the concession. I've never understood movie concessions. I feel like going off on a little aside here is I think movie concessions is outrageous. Now, movie theaters, they don't make any money off ticket sales. I think on a new release movie for the opening weekend, I think the theater retains like 2 cents for every ticket sold. Now, the longer the movie is in the theater, the bigger the percentage the theater, that particular theater chain or that theater gets for each ticket sold. And it's up, I mean, that's, I think it's fair to put that up to them for the marketing and try to get people in the theater to whatever they're doing to like, to do different sales and, you know, different bargain days to get people to still come see movies. But I mean, it's not, when you go to a theater and you say the inevitable, God, this is so expensive, and then the person behind the concession says, well, it's how we make our money. You know, that conversation's happened a million times. I've even said to people when I was working in movie theater in high school, it is how they make their money. But you don't need to, like, absorbently gouge a bag of popcorn. That large popcorn you're buying for $7 or $8, even $9, $10 in some cities these days, costs the theater less than 40 cents to... That's including the container and the butter that went into making it and the salt. And they're making like 10,000% markup.
It's crazy. It is.
Nick, give me the theater you go to, when you walk up to concessions, now you don't have to tell me what theater is, but what is the price of a large popcorn and a large drink? Do you know off the top of your head?
I want to say both. I think they have like deals, maybe $10.25.
That's a lot of money for 15 cents worth of soda and 30 cents worth of popcorn.
Exactly, and you know what? I may even be underselling it because
I think you are.
Yeah, it's probably somewhere around $14. I know for like a large drink, it's like $7, and maybe the same for a popcorn.
That's popcorn. I've always thought concession prices were outrageous. When I was 16, I started at Carmike Cinemas in St. Clairsville, Ohio. I know a lot of our listeners probably weren't even alive then, but there was a large popcorn and a large drink was $7.35. I remember, $7.45. That was the cost of a large popcorn and a large drink. And there was a candy that was $2.10 and a candy that was $2 and And 240. We didn't deal with pennies. We just deal with nickels, quarters, and dimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was. I even thought then, like, my God, this is outrageously expensive. Of course, that was when minimum wage was. I think it just moved up to $5.15 an hour from $4.75. I don't remember. That's so long ago. But that concession prices and even ticket prices are just so outrageous. I can't even imagine it. Here in Chicago, you pay. I think the two or three theaters I tend to share my business with, I tend to frequent. I think a child price is anywhere from 8 to 10, and an adult price is anywhere from $14.50 to $17.50. Now that's,
wow, really?
You can't even buy that with, minimum wage in Chicago is now, in Illinois is now
mm-hmm.
11, I think $11 now. It just went up maybe last week, the week before. But I mean, you cannot buy an adult admission for 1 hour of minimum wage. I think that's wrong. I don't think that's right.
That's absolutely insane, and wow, that's crazy. $17 almost for a ticket.
And when you put it into perspective, I saw a movie. I saw Transformers in 3D. That was $26.75.
Oh wow!
That was.
See, I just noticed yesterday when I went to see Dunkirk. I just noticed that the place I go to, they just raised their adult ticket to. I think it's like $12.20 or something.
That's still so much. I mean, minimum wage. Exactly. What's minimum wage in Pennsylvania these days? $8.25, $8 maybe.
Yeah, somewhere around there.
That's ridiculous. That's almost an hour and a half. It's almost 2 hours of the work. It's not proportionate. Now, okay.
Yeah.
The counter argument, of course, is you're getting 2 hours of entertainment. Yes and no. The products delivered these days I wouldn't say you're entertained for the full 2 hours, but
you could be walking into a flop. You don't know.
I mean, yeah. You don't know for sure. I mean, it's this debate never has an end. It's been going on since movie theaters were a thing. But I feel like at one time they were properly and proportionately priced. It just inflation has been insane. But I have a lot to say on the movie theater, how things operate at a movie theater. I've worked in them for a long time. I've known several managers. I don't agree with everything they do. I do agree with no outside food or drink. And if your argument is, I need something to drink. Well, can you just not wait 2 hours and then just get something to drink on your way out, like out of the water fountain? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
You don't need to. I love those people. The people that complain about it at the concession, they say it's so expensive. They say, this is outrageous. Give me 2 large drinks and large popcorn.
Yeah. All right, sir, that'd be $28.50, please.
I mean, you in this economy, in American life, you vote with your wallet a lot of times.
Yeah.
So that's you're saying one thing, you're doing another. So that's very mixed signal you're sending. So those are, I think, the tip of the iceberg for the argument versus Netflix and movie theater. I will always prefer to watch a movie in the movie theater, and I will always prefer to watch it on 70mm and on. I would always prefer to watch a movie and on actual film rather than digital any day of the week.
Mm-hmm.
That's just me, my personal preference. A lot of people don't share that, and that's fine. It's just that's my personal preference. Nick, have you seen any of these trailers?
I saw the Jigsaw trailer and the Snowman trailer.
Jigsaw is back. Nick Morris, what do you think about Jigsaw being back? He just won't stay dead. He won't stay.
When will it end? I thought it was over with the last Saw movie. What was it? Saw 6.
I think it was Saw 7 or 8.
Saw
7. I
don't know. I will say the trailer. It got my goosebumps rising off my arms.
That's funny. That's funny. What you just said, when is it going to be the end? I think a lot of people have been saying that since Saw 3. Like, when's it going to be the end? Saw 4. When's it going to be the end? Saw 5. When's it going to be the end? I like that. Although, I will say, I once wrote a paper in college about Jigs. I was writing for the paper, and that was when The Dark Knight came out, and everyone was like, "That's Dark Knight is the best movie ever." And I was like, hold on. No, it's not. Let me tell you why. You know me. I like to go against the grain whenever I can. But
yeah.
I ended up pointing out The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, which is a parallel I'm always going to draw with The Dark Knight, because it's the same movie that he just stole. Again, that's why Nolan cannot be great, at least right now. But I thought that Jigsaw in the first Saw movie could be considered one of those brilliant villains on the same level as Hannibal Lecter. I think that's a fair comparison to make. It's when Saw keeps getting dragged on and on, it just gets so ridiculous.
Yeah, I agree, and I think that's why. I mean, I remember watching the first Saw movie, and I thought it was brilliant. I mean, he was just laying there the whole time, you know? Like, it was such an unexpected moment, you know?
13-year spoiler, it's him on the floor.
Yeah, sorry everyone, spoiler alert.
And that was 2004. I was still working at the same movie theater and in high school. I was just starting college then. And I can remember people saying, oh, I knew it was him the whole time. Like, no, you did not. No one knew that. No, you couldn't have. The movie did not give you enough information to know that. I think it was deliberate, but the movie did not give you enough information to put that together. And I don't know where I sit on that, because the shock value in the end, I almost say it was worth it to me, because I'm like, oh my goodness, that was awesome. But Jigsaw's back, Jigsaw trailer, he's causing hell again. Tobin Bell as Jigsaw, I'm okay with it. I love Tobin Bell.
Of course.
He is creepy. He's a creepy... You know, as a matter of fact, if I saw him walking towards me on the sidewalk, I would walk in the other direction, because I knew, Jigsaw, man, it's coming after you.
I think it's his voice that really gets me.
You're going to wake up and this little dude in the tricycle is going to ride out and ask you if you want to play a game. No, I don't want to play a game. I want to go home. Then we have the Snowman trailer. Michael Fassbender, Rebecca Ferguson, who actually on IMDb has a higher billing than Michael Fassbender, given everything that Michael Fassbender is in lately. He was in the 300 movie, well, not lately, but the 300 movie. He was in the Alien, the two Alien movies. He's been in quite a few things. Rebecca Ferguson has a higher billing than both Michael Fassbender and Val Kilmer. Now, in this trailer for The Snowman, Val Kilmer is nowhere to be seen. So I think speculation is you can assume that Val Kilmer is the killer.
Okay.
I mean, that's... Right. I don't have any outside information. I'm not like... I don't have any inside trading information. I'm just saying...
But, I mean, that's a pretty good guess. I mean...
Val Kilmer is a household name. Even though he's not been in a lot lately, he's still... You know, I mean, Top Gun 2 is a thing, and, you know, the 80s and the 90s were, you know, he was one of the guys that was being pushed on everyone in the movies in the 90s, 80s and 90s, Val Kilmer. So that, the Snowman is a, I don't want to say horror, I want to say psychological thriller involving a guy who likes to use snowman tropes to elude the people hunting him. I mean, it's, the thing that separates this from, I think, Polaroid is the fact that this will be kind of a brilliant psychological thriller. Two things lead me down this road. One, I don't think Fassbender would have taken it had this movie not had a chance to like really be great in the psychological thriller era. Maybe like Prisoners, movie with Jake Gyllenhaal and Hugh Jackman. There's a long list. Girls Dragon Tattoo. Even I'm hoping this is a good movie. Even you know The Babadook. Even for a little while was pretty intelligent. The second half sucked, but you know. And then we have First Kill with Hayden Christensen and Bruce Willis. Now, I have a buddy who is the most famousest of all kids from Pittsburgh. He travels on, I think he just went to France to work on a movie. He's like Paramount's number one guy for accounting. He is the most famousest of all Pittsburgh kids. Mike Day said, you met Mike Day, didn't you?
Yeah, I worked audio with him.
Yeah, Mike Day, he's a character. Believe me when I say, I'm going to make this announcement right now, Mike Day will be president of the world within the next 20 years. I guarantee it. Boy, that guy is just smooth. But anyway,
he's a really cool guy. Down to earth.
He said to me one day, Grayson, Hayden Christensen will never be considered an actor. Mike Day, I think the day has come when Hayden Christensen has finally become an actor. Hayden Christensen and Bruce Willis, this is another, I guess, psychological thriller. Christensen's son is kidnapped, and him and Bruce have to work to get him back. I don't want to reveal more, because the trailer is actually quite intriguing, so you should definitely watch the trailer. I was actually very surprised and excited by this trailer. I think of the three trailers in this one, that's the one I want to see the most, given what was in the trailer. I mean, given purely the content of the trailer, when you bring into account the actors and everything else, I think the Snowman takes the cake with Fassbender and Ferguson.
Oh yeah.
So that I think there's some interesting trailers this week to watch. Now, as a note, I think First Kill actually came out this week in theaters. I hadn't seen the trailer. I just thought it'd be interesting to throw up there. So we have. Oh boy! Now the meat. War for Planet of the Apes. Now you said you liked it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What do you think of now? Just for a little bit of perspective here, Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And actually, there's a little statistic I wanted to share with. I think the first Apes movie was in 1968.
It was.
That was 1968. Charlton Heston, Roddy McDowall, Kim Hunter, Maurice Evans. That's how long this franchise has been coming and going. So, 1968.
Quick note. Before I went to see War for the Planet of the Apes, I was leaving my house and my grandmother asked me. She's like, hey, what are you doing? I said, I'm about to go see a movie. She's like, what? I said, War for the Planet of the Apes. She's like, oh, I remember when the first one came out. I said, yeah, in 1968, Grandma?
what did she say?
She said, she put her head down. She's like, yeah. And I just left. I don't know.
Well, I mean, sorry, Nick, one day you're going to be saying that to your grandkids. So, I mean, yeah. how funny can it be now? Karma's going to get you, dude. Karma's going to come back around. How is Grandma Morris? Is she doing okay?
Yeah, she's doing fantastic. Enjoying retirement.
I'm glad. I'm glad she's out there. I'm sure she's out there kicking ass. What else? Oh, so, Planet of the Apes. Okay, so a little perspective. Rise of the Planet of the Apes, this franchise starting over, was in August 2011, $93 million budget, $480 million box office worldwide. I think that surprised people. I didn't think people expected that movie to make that much money. That was James Franco. Who else was in that? I just watched it. Who else was in that? James Franco, John Lithgow, and Andy Serkis as the adult Caesar. And I mean, Andy Serkis, the man needs no introduction. He's got a resume a mile long.
Oh, yeah.
He is the father of the mocap. So that, I mean, he's doing great. So Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I have a couple points I want to hit before we move into War for Planet of the Apes, which is, I hope, the third and final movie in the trilogy. They're calling it the Apes Trilogy, and I hope it stays a trilogy. However, so some points I want to hit. Rise for Planet of the Apes. A little bit of a timeline. I mean, this might not be definitive, but I was just making notes as I was watching them. Point one, Caesar is born into conflict. His mother dies trying to defend him, and then they discover she was being violent because of she was defending her child, her baby monkey, her ape, baby ape. Rise of the Planet of the Apes was, if you have to give a quick synopsis, is the apes becoming, one ape becoming a leader to other intelligent apes, and literally they are rising up and getting out of their captors. Well, I don't want to call it captors, or I wouldn't call it prison, because they're just being experimented on, but...
Yeah, exactly. They're being experimented on, and basically beaten, and I mean, treated cruelly.
Well, they were testing drugs on apes to work all the kinks out and make sure that they don't hurt humans. So, I mean, that's very cruel. That's cruel and unusual punishment, no matter how you look at it, regardless.
Well, it was a memory drug, wasn't it? To help cure
Alzheimer's.
Alzheimer's, yeah.
I think he called it ALZ-112. Let me check my notes here. Yeah, I think it's ALZ-112. It was supposed to cure. It's supposed to relink synapses in the brain. So that's, and they stumbled upon what another effect. So the first moment I think in Caesar's development when he's a young chimp is when he's discovered and taken home illegally by James Franco's character is he asks permission by putting his head down and extending his hand and waiting for Franco to touch his hand and say it's okay. You know, that's, I think, the first defining moment of Caesar becoming kind of a brilliant ape, and I mean the beginning of becoming a leader is he's he's asking, well, he is now asking for permission, which is going to lead to a huge miss, I think, coming up in the third movie. But he asking for permission. The second moment in Rise of Planet of the Apes, which again 2011. So I'm sorry if I spoil anything. It's been, you should have seen it. The second moment I think was when he was an adolescent ape, and he was in the upstairs looking down when John Lithgow, Will's father, Charles, wanders outside. Again, his disease is returning with a vengeance because they have worked out all the kinks, and he, a neighbor is giving him problems, and he busts out of his house, Will's house, and beats up the neighbor. And that's, you know, that's showing, that's another very important moment. He shows he's got some aggression, but he's smart enough to realize that his familial ties are being threatened, and he needs to defend that. His people, as you would call it, are being threatened. So the third moment in Rise I think is important to mention is when Will takes him to, because of that incident, Will takes him by court order, he's taken to kind of a, what do you call it? I don't want to call it a, he's taken to like an atrium with other monkeys. For some reason, there are tons of apes in this atrium, which, now I think about it, is that the Harry Potter nemesis that plays? I don't remember. I should look that up. I don't remember. Yeah, Malfoy, yeah. I should look that up. I don't remember. It could be. He is forced to stay there against his will, unable to go home with Will, the only familial tie he has. And during that time, there's a showdown in the atrium with both Malfoy, I think it's Malfoy, with both Malfoy and another ape. Important part here is Caesar starts to speak. He's, you know, one-word sentences, but very powerful. One word at a time. And he ends up taking over the atrium and defeating the ape that is standing in his way to becoming the leader. Much like a prison, much like you would in a prison, you know?
Exactly.
The fourth moment, I think, in Rise is when he frees the apes and they fight their way across the bridge. Now, this is kind of where I have a problem, because they fight their way across the bridge against men with guns, against military with guns, which I don't... That's just me maybe trying to get the film more grounded than it was. Is why were they not successful in stopping the apes? Why? That's an important moment in Rise, and he's doing that because to get across the bridge, there is a huge, after he's freed his friends, there's a huge redwood forest over on the side, and he wants to make a home for his people. That is Rise of the Planet of the Apes in a very brief way. Now, Dawn picks up with the simian flu has wiped out much of humanity, and there's kind of a war starting to brew on the surface. It's not war yet, but it's the makings of the war are there. You still with me, Nick?
Yeah, let me stop you there for a second.
Sure.
I don't want to... I'm trying to recap what the simian flu is. Now, is it like The Walking Dead, where everyone has it, right? Did I catch that right from the third movie? Or, because I'm pretty sure someone said that everyone has it.
I think everyone has it. You know what? I'm sorry, I didn't write that down. I should have. I guess I just never caught it as I was watching in the past couple of nights. I didn't.
Maybe I'm wrong. I think I heard or caught something from it, but I think they all have it, but they just... I don't know. I'm gonna stop talking.
No, I mean, it's fine. I don't... Unfortunately, I don't remember what the... I just remembered it as the simian flu, and that's what wiped out most of people. There were... And after this flu had taken its toll, there were... pockets of people left, but not enough to really re-inhabit the Earth. And, I mean, everything is over... In Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, everything is overgrown. People are kind of living hand to foot, meaning they are scrounging for resources, living in cities, you know, some without power, some really looking for food. It shows what I thought was, I was really impressed. I've always impressed by how the movie Dawn of the Apes started. There's almost no dialogue for like the first 15 minutes of the movie. Like none. It's just apes communicating through sign language with Caesar, and Caesar communicating back. And you slowly start to see they have a colony established. There are lots of them. They are very intelligent. They have, you know, living quarters. They have, you know, huge, almost like an Ewok village from Star Wars. They have built this wonderful village, and that's the colony that they have established. And I think one of the first moments here is, the first important moment here is, there's trouble brewing, and intruders by Malcolm and his people, and Dreyfus by Gary Oldman, there's a small band of people that come up, find some apes, and one of the apes is shot. I think Caesar's son's friend, Ash, is shot. That, of course, causes Caesar to rally his troops and ride to the human settlement. And I think he says these words. He's speaking more fluent sentences, not just one word, but he's speaking in, I think, broken speech, but you can understand, you can make out that there's a sentence forming to show you the kind of the progression of Caesar at this point. Apes not want war, but will fight if must. So, I mean, again, I love that shows that there's a very fragile peace. Anything's going to break it. I mean, one more Jenga on the top of the Jenga, and it's one more straw on the camel's back is broken.
Yeah.
But during this piece, he allows Malcolm to try to salvage what they can from the hydroelectric dam and see if they can get power. And during this little excursion, one of the apes, again, is threatened by a gun that should not have been there, and the whatever trust was almost regained is now gone, at least for right now. And the fragile piece is once again super fragile. And I want to make a mention that when Caesar rides up with his army to the, it's Malcolm that rides, that walks up to him and tries to be the ambassador for the humans. I think that's a very interesting shot. As you see this, you see him standing there, and there's tons of apes on horseback with weapons, very armed, very ready to kill. I love that shot. I love that shot. And the second moment is Ellie, which is Malcolm's wife, Carrie Russell, heals Caesar's wife. And there's an instant, you know, kind of a parallel there, you know, a leader and his wife, and then Malcolm has his kid, Caesar has his kid. You know, I mean, there's a parallel there, and, you know, he has his wife, Ellie, and then Caesar has his wife. And Ellie tries to heal the wife with antibiotics. And again, a little of the trust is rebuilt. Moment number three. Koba is not okay with this arrangement where they're not attacking each other. Koba wants to kill the people. He wants to destroy them, get rid of them. So Koba comes up with a plan after he finds the gun cache to set fire to the settlement, and shoot Caesar and blame it on the humans, only he doesn't kill Caesar, which is a problem. So Koba is now the betrayer, and now war is inevitable. Peace isn't possible anymore. Moment number four, Malcolm and Ellie save Caesar. They find him half dead. They take him back to a house, and they save him, and trust is repaired. The final moment in Dawn is Caesar confronts Koba, and the city is exploded through means, and the military is coming, and the war has started. And that brings us to War for Planet of the Apes, which I thought was an odd title, because Rise of Planet of the Apes and Dawn of Planet of the Apes almost, to me, are the same thing. Like, I would not... What do you think about that?
I mean, I agree with you. It's just... I mean... I don't know. What do you gotta do?
I mean, I just think the word choice was weird. I mean, maybe I'm not seeing something very simple here, but I really did not like that word choice. But War for Planet of the Apes, you know what you're going into when you go into this movie. There is no more peace. There's no more, you know, pussyfooting around it. It's war, and that's what's going to happen. So that brings us to the movie of the day. So War for Planet of the Apes, again, it has an adult Caesar who is now speaking very, very big sentence. Well, he's not speaking broken English anymore. You know, he's speaking full sentences, and he is absolutely the leader of the apes, which has taken two movies to get there.
Oh, yeah.
But he is absolutely. Go on, sorry.
I think Caesar's a little older, you know? I mean, he's starting to have a little bit of grays throughout his hair.
Well, that's the character progression is. You see that in the beginning of Rise, with he's a little chimp, and then by the end of War, he is, well, when War rolls around, he is very much adult. He's got, he's grizzled, he's worn, he's, you know, fought lots of battles, he's had to kill one of his, at one time, very trusted lieutenants. Yeah. He's, you know, he's Caesar, he's the leader of the apes. So, War of the Planet of the Apes, very dark tone. There is, I think, a very stark contrast between War, which is terrible, set in this almost post-apocalyptic world where they're really both tribes. I say tribes. One tribe is the apes. One tribe is the humans. They're both suffering. They're both, you know, now on very limited resources. I mean, as far as numbers go. I mean, this.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is interesting. Go on, sorry.
At this time, I think you're probably going to go more into detail about it. I mean, everything's growing back. You know, cities are being overtaken by the environment. You know, Mother Nature is rising up also. You know? And, I mean, it's just getting to that point where what is civilization anymore? I mean, they still have an army, of course. But even they had to go, farther north?
They did go far north. Well, but before we get there, that's an interesting point you bring up that I wanted to... That was kind of how Rise ended, was that big long shot of... San Francisco?
Yeah.
San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge, and then over the Redwood. They kind of ended with that shot, and then you saw it... And then you saw it in Dawn, the very early shots in Dawn, and it was the same area being covered, but it was completely overgrown. No more, you know, there was nothing else. There was, everything was returning to the land. And on this one, they were living off the land. They didn't, you know, there was no more power. There was no nothing. They were just living like a Native American would have, I guess, with whatever nature gave them. Which is kind of cool. I liked that when they sat down to make this post-apocalyptic world, it wasn't like the Mad Max post-apocalyptic world or the Book of Eli, a post-apocalyptic world where it'd blown up by a bomb or something. It was just nature reclaiming what nature had in the beginning, which is, I thought was a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, I did too. I quite enjoyed that.
Now, I don't want to go over moments because I don't want to get into moments and then not finish them, but one thing I really loved, and it's slightly early on, is they find this girl who they call Nova.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this one really, really wonderful scene between Nova and one of the apes. And I don't think Nova's a spoiler. She's in the poster. She's in the trailer. I think everyone's very aware there's a little girl in this movie. And what she represents, I think, is the interesting part is... I always harp on... I love Terminator because it's James Cameron approached it, the second one, by, you know, who's more human, the Terminator or John Connor? Like, what does it mean to become human? You know, and the Terminator becomes more human than any of them when he gives that thumbs up. I think the girl in this one represents a return to pure humanity again. You know, she's, even though she's a girl, she is a human, she's not violent. You know, and she's friends with the apes. So, I mean, as far as her character's concerned, she could just be an ape. I mean, you know, I mean, by extension, she could just be an ape. So she's really not identified with either tribe, which is what I love. And before we get into that, she is played by Amia Miller. And I want to just give a little background on her, what she's been in. She has been in... Why don't I see this? Off and on. She's been in quite a few things, actually. She has 12 things on her belt for as young as she is. She is War of the Planet of the Apes. She's in a TV series, MacGyver. Lights Out, a TV series. She's in another one. She's in a Richie Rich TV series, Best Friends Whenever series. So a lot of TV stuff. But
a lot of stuff I probably haven't seen.
Yeah, my point is she caught someone's eye.
Yeah, exactly.
So of that I'm okay, but they find her. And there's this wonderful scene that takes place between... The scene almost makes the entire movie worth the ticket price for me is... She... And we're seeing it from the other side. Because we're seeing the colonel and his troops. We usually identify with them fighting off whatever's making them extinct. You know, we usually side with them, which is what I think is interesting. Is by in this movie, you actually want the apes to get rid of the Colonel and his men because they're only out to destroy the apes. The apes are okay with living in harmony and in tandem. They passed that, but the humans are not.
Exactly, and that's one of the points I actually wanted to bring up with you too. Is you know it's hard to you really can't choose a side because you want the apes to win, but you don't want humanity to fall.
And this is for me. This is the first time I didn't want now in the Charlton Heston ones and in the many he was in. I did not want the apes to win. And in the Mark Wahlberg movie again. Sorry, spoiler from 2003, 14-year spoiler. He beats you know they win the day and he goes back to his ship and he comes back to Earth. And everything is Thade has beat him back, and everything is apes.
Yep.
I was like, "What? This is not a fun ending. I don't want
no." It was not a fun ending.
No. So the first time I actually wanted the apes to win this one, and that was for me. That's a big deal. So
exactly.
There's a beautiful moment where this girl, an ape, who's with this girl, finds the one flower. The beauty has peeked through the snow, this one flower, and puts it in her ear, which is going to come into play later. And it's this wonderful music playing in the background. It's a wonderful little scene, which gives a stark contrast to where we are in the story with war and nothing good comes of war. And then you have this calm, serene beauty that just, you know, like the flower popping up out of the snow, like the single rose that pops up out of the snow, that trope there, that's a very big contrast there. So that's, I think, a beautiful moment.
And it gave another side to the ape. You know, it built a little bit of his character.
You know, I totally agree with you there. There's several apes with Caesar. Caesar is on a journey. This film opens kind of a very similar way to Dawn of Planet of the Apes, where there is a contingent of U.S. military encroaching on an ape outpost with the intent on killing all of them, and the attack is repelled. But the important part here is there are apes with the humans. They call them donkeys, I guess, in the same way that, I mean, in the Middle East, I guess we, you know, whoever wants to fight with us in the Middle, I guess in a weird way, I don't mean to get into social commentary, but there's got to be something along those lines in that. I mean, there's got to be some hint of social commentary there. But it's the indigenous people are fighting with, you know, the people that are trying to be pushed out. So,
exactly. Yeah.
And in this scene when they're fighting, the ape, which is a big setup and payoff later, he sees this ape who is helping the humans, looks up from behind the log when there's a firefight, and seeing his species being gunned down by these, you know, very well-trained, got lots of technology, lots of good weapons. She's seeing him being shot down, and of course he doesn't do anything. As an ape, he doesn't care that, I mean, it's not moved him yet enough, I guess, as the character arc of the story that it matters. But after that, Caesar, they repel the attack, and when the interesting phrase here, I think is almost a thesis to the movie, is when the apes are wanting revenge, Caesar, he sends the few surviving attackers away, and when his fellow apes ask him why, he says, "They will see we are not savages. You know, we can. It is possible that we're not. You know, I love that as far as like
exactly. It was showing. Yeah, it was exactly what you're probably about to say. It shows that he's not looking for war.
No,
you know, he's done with that. He just wants to live out his life. You know, be the best simian he can be.
He wants to find a place for his people and just be left to hell alone.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is, he's had conflict since he was born into conflict. Like, he was born because of it. Like, his mother died defending him in a lab with people trying to hurt his mother. Like, he was born from and in conflict. Yeah. So, I mean, he's been in conflict his entire life. Which is, that's a contrast this movie really, really does well to highlight. And then we have the setup. Excuse me, I'm losing my train of thought. We have the setup there. where, and then Caesar instructs his people to take the Exodus to, or whatever you want to call it, the journey, the Exodus, to find a land, and he's going to go deal with the colonel himself. Because the colonel has come to his home, come inside, and he has the colonel and his men, even after the first attack, they came back after they were granted terms to leave and killed more apes. And Caesar is going to go finish it. And that's kind of where this movie picks up, is Caesar is going to go finish it, and some of the people go along with him, which brings us back to the moment in the wild, in the snow, with the flower and the girl. That's a wonderful setup. Now, the colonel, that's always called, I think, is the colonel, is by Woody Harrelson, and he's a real son of a gun.
Oh, man. I like how you put it. I mean, he is a real son of a gun. He's a demented colonel, and I thought Woody Harrelson played the hell out of that role.
Yeah, he was good. I mean, I would walk the other way if I saw Woody Harrelson in his full military camo gear. I'd walk the other way because he is nuts. He doesn't have a problem with killing every ape he comes across. He has no problem just putting a gun to their head and pulling the trigger. I mean, figure of speech. I don't think he ever does that, but figure of speech. But he's a ruthless son of a gun, and it's
exactly.
He's a son of a gun. So, and he does it. He really owns that role. Like you said, he owns that role, and he's using apes as slaves to build his wall from an attack he knows is coming from other humans.
Yeah, which
I'm not sure that was ever really touched upon, other than maybe I just completely missed it. I don't know, but
I think I'm losing my train of thought too, but I think they mention it a little bit, but it's not like a big thing. Yeah, you know, like they don't go into detail about it.
Yeah, so I mean, that's, I don't think it's ever really explored, but and Maurice makes a return. Maurice is kind of the emotional center. He's kind of how Caesar is grounded. The ape, the kind of the orangish red ape. Maurice is kind of Caesar's kind of right hand man at this point. Now that Koba is no longer around, but he's Maurice is kind of the emotional center. And I think somewhere in the middle. Caesar said all
he's the voice of reason.
Yeah, he is a voice. He's the older guy that is able to pull Caesar back and say, no, you know, be careful with this. But he says to Caesar says that he wants revenge, and then Maurice looks at him, which I thought was a wonderful, I always say a miss, but this was definitely a hit. This is a wonderful moment, is when Maurice says, "Now you sound like Koba." I mean, Koba almost single-handedly, you know, Koba's the one that started the war with a single gunshot. So, I mean, Koba's he was a piece of work, too. So, they're all pieces of work, all of them.
Exactly.
So, I mean, that's kind of really, so, with all those pieces in play, I'm not going to go into any more detail, but for all those pieces in play, this movie really does well what it set out to do, and I didn't want to like this movie going into it. Because I like Dawn so much, I was like, there's no way I'm going to like this movie. I so rarely like more than one movie in a franchise. Now, granted, the obvious rebuttal here is, oh, but you like Transformers. Yeah, but I like those on a level that are not quality. I just love to watch them because they're so much fun.
Yeah, that's very true.
So I really think this movie is quite good. And I think quite good coming from me really means something. Yeah. I think it's maybe one of the better movies of the summer, I hope. I hope it's not. I hope, you know, Dark Tower is good and this is kind of on that same level. It's got a lot of interesting things going on, you know, beneath the surface, which is the stark contrast between the beauty and the war. War is ugly, beauty is great. You know, you have people like Caesar and his men that start to see that this is a slog, that this is, it's almost a stalemate. I was thinking in Wonder Woman terms, I was thinking no man's land, I was a slog, stalemate. But this is, you know, it's one of those things that's,
this it's has a battle that they think they can't win.
I think Caesar for the first time in this movie thinks he realizes he probably cannot win this.
Yeah.
I don't think there's ever a line of dialogue that directly relates to that, but that's just my kind of how I took away from it was Caesar understands that there's a bigger picture here,
exactly,
and what he has to do to get his people to safety. So I actually really enjoy this movie. I really hope people see this movie more than once, more than twice. And I wanted to get into it on the Nolan I spoke earlier on. This is absolutely a movie you need to see on the big screen.
Oh, yeah.
Please do not watch this on your 40-inch TV on Netflix a year and a half from now. Do yourself a favor and see this. This is a big spectacle. This is, you know, you should definitely watch. But basically because it, you know, technology has now allowed us to get to a point where, you know, Andy Serkis looks, you know, it's not like Lord of the Rings where sometimes you could tell that, that's not Gollum, that's a guy in a costume. But
yeah.
In this, like, that's an ape, like, for sure, they trained an ape to talk, and that's Caesar. So I really enjoyed this. I hope you guys do too. I hope everyone does.
I agree with you, and I think everyone should go see it too. Question for you, Grayson.
Shoot.
Now, I don't know how I feel about it, but I know I see some things on Twitter that say, should Andy Serkis, does he deserve an Oscar for his role as Caesar?
Wait, I have not seen any of these tweets, whatever. What are they?
Maybe it was an Oscar or something, but it was definitely people want him to be rewarded. You know.
Oh! So you weren't playing devil's advocate. You were saying he definitely deserves for this role.
You know, I don't know.
Or are you being devil's?
I just dug a hole for myself.
Oh no! I mean, it's, you know, your personal opinion is your personal opinion. You can never be faulted for that. I mean, I think he probably, given what I saw on Planet of the Apes, I would say, yeah, my experience, yes, that's always groundbreaking. I mean, technology's moving forward at a much faster rate than was realized, especially with mocap, but that's, for sure, that's a hell of an achievement, is Caesar in Planet of the Apes. Now, if he gets it, I hope he gets it, you know, for all three, you know, not just for War, but like, okay, he won it for War, but he's really winning it for all three, and that's kind of what I wanted to, so... Nick, do you have any closing thoughts on, without spoiling anything, on War for Planet of the Apes?
Go see it. There's a lot of, I wouldn't say a lot of unexpected things, but there are. And, I don't know, it's great. I think the story tied in well, and I hope. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that they will end it there, but I think it is a good ending. For the trilogy, as you were saying.
I agree. Just by saying I hope it's the last movie, and that doesn't mean I spoil anything, but I really do hope it's the last movie. This end movie actually ends quite beautifully. Wonderful the way it ends. I actually, for the first time in a long time, have no qualms at all with the last, you know, 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So I'm very... very happy with it, but I really think this movie is a pretty solid movie. I'm really glad that it. Again, I didn't want to like it, but I do. Now, moving on to, well, the Clark Hayes list of movies you should probably watch. This is one of my favorite segments on the show. I like to talk about movies I really love, and this one. I went back and forth. I wanted to for a few days. I wanted to include a movie that has something to do with an ape. But then I really got to thinking about War for Planet of the Apes, and I really sat down and, you know, put my brain behind it. Nick, I wanted to, I think War for Planet of the Apes, I ultimately think is more about the journey coming to an end, and the importance of Caesar, Caesar finding a place for his people and not, you know, I mean, not failing in his endeavor to do that, to lead his people to freedom. So I really... So I have stumbled upon a movie that a lot of people, I don't think it's a great movie. However, I'm a big fan of it. The Book of Eli by the Hughes Brothers in 2010. This, much like Planet of the Apes, is a struggle to maintain. This is going to sound weird, but even the apes they're trying to maintain their humanity. They're trying to not become Koba. They're trying to not become bloodlust, and, you know, they're trying to maintain what they are and save how many they can, and it's about, I think, at the end of the journey. And the Book of Eli, I think, is no different. It's a struggle of a man to save a book, and I think the movie goes a little far. And, you know, he's trying to save the book to save humanity. I don't think it's saving humanity. I think he's saving something, the bigger picture,
yeah.
Which is,
isn't everyone trying to get the book?
Yeah, everyone's trying to steal his book when because they think it's helping him do magical things.
Yeah.
And of course, Denzel Washington is Eli, and in very much like Planet of the Apes, in a different kind of post-apocalyptic world, but a post-apocalyptic world nonetheless. The war tore a hole in the sky, and the sun has just destroyed everything. But he is walking east to west in hopes of reaching a destination that, until the very end of the movie, you don't have any idea what it is. You don't even know what he's carrying until most of the way through. And he meets up with this girl, played by Mila Kunis, and she is kind of, in a way, a little bit of his redemption. Helps remind him of what he has lost and kind of get that back. Now, there's a huge twist in the end of this movie, and even though it came out in 2010, I'm not going to ruin the twist, but it's more than what it comes down to is he was being, you know, faith has really helped him get from point A to point B, even protecting this girl, Mila Kunis, and along the way, he's, you know, they've come in contact with people they've lost because Gary Oldman is also, it's Gary Oldman, right? Yeah, it is Gary Oldman.
Mm-hmm.
Who's obsessed with getting this book from Eli. Again, Gary Oldman is the villain here too, much like he was in Dawn of Planet of the Apes. They're trying to get this book from him because they think it's got magical power, that it's helping him do what he's doing. And I guess what it comes down to is faith is helping him do what he's doing, and he's believed this whole time that his quest is one worth taking, much like Caesar's quest to bring his people, free his people, find them some place to live where they won't be bothered anymore. You know, and that's why I chose the Book of Eli. It's a good movie to watch once, maybe twice. I'm not sure about a number of times, but three reasons. It's kind of a wonderful vision of a post-apocalyptic world brought on by the Hughes brothers. I think it doesn't fall into the same tropes that you would think going into it, given that we'd already had Mad Max at that point, what we'd had as far as a broken world. It's just, yeah. It's a bleak landscape. It's all arid desert. It's ugly, but it's got some good people there. I think there's some really wonderful contrast between the scenes when he's in the desert and opposed to in this kind of a weird forest when he starts. It's really wonderful that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want people to experience it. Number two, Mila Kunis and Denzel Washington work pretty well together. I really think. I'm going somewhere with this. And Gary Oldman is the villain. Gary Oldman's a wonderful villain. He's a wonderful actor to begin with. But he was also, that same year, I think he was a villain in Red Riding Hood. And he was kind of the same person, which I thought was interesting. He was kind of the same character as he was in Red Riding. Kind of just obsessed with finding her and, you know, finding out who the wolf was. But and the third reason is I always do a scene. There's a conversation in a silo where she's desperately trying to get at this item that, the book, as the title, the Book of Eli, she's desperately trying to see what's in this book because she is as curious as everyone else is. And he explains to her through a wonderful conversation that it doesn't matter what it is, it's getting him from point A to point B. That's a wonderful conversation, led by faith. And that is a movie worth watching. It's a movie worth having in your collection, I think, for sure. The runner-up, if it makes a difference, if people are wondering, was Gorillas in the Mist, the Sigourney Weaver, which I was going to make a tie to James Cameron. I thought, you know what, I'll give James Cameron a break this week. So that was the runner-up, but Book of Eli won that. So Nick, we watched some good movies this week. We saw War of Planet of the Apes.
Yes.
You're happy with it, yes?
Yes, very true. Very true, I am.
All right, where can people find you, Nick? What's your Twitter handle?
They can find me on Twitter at nmorris. 1776.
Why 1776?
Because I'm very American. You know, I got the American spirit running through me.
Were you?
I bleed red, white, and blue, Grayson.
Yeah, buddy.
I love American films.
Love American.
I just found this out the other day. There's a place called Nollywood, and I'm guessing every country has their own version of Hollywood, but Africa has Nollywood, where it's a Nigerian Hollywood. I just found this out the other day while I was listening to some public broadcasting radio. It just blew my mind. You know, of course, we all knew about Bollywood, in India.
Yeah.
But isn't that a little crazy, Grayson?
I mean, yes, no. I mean, it's. I guess it's a term given to them, but I mean, everyone makes movies, so.
Wow, you're right.
I mean, I guess they look at it as the opposite of, oh, over in the United States, it's Hollywood, and they're like, Nollywood was the first, you know, I mean, I guess they look at it the same way you looked at it as theirs being the other, they look at ours being the other, I guess, I don't know. I mean, everywhere in the world's making movies, we're seeing wonderful movies, which, bringing it full circle, Netflix is helping to distribute, so.
Very true.
The devil Netflix. I mean, the devil according to Nolan. I mean... Netflix isn't always. I mean, it's helping some filmmakers that ordinarily wouldn't get anything out. It helps get them get smaller distributed things to mass audiences, which, I mean, in a very optimistic world, is going to help find wonderful filmmakers when at a different day they would never have been recognized at all.
Yeah.
So that's always a good thing. But what I don't like is this YouTube generation. Just they just want to get views and hits, and they want to be famous. You know, for a few weeks I was guilty of that, but...
I mean, I'm not gonna apologize to Christopher Nolan, but Netflix is my main streaming, you know, that's where I get my stuff, that's my fix.
Did you hear that, Nolan? Nick said he's not sorry. Did you hear that? You're gonna get an angry phone call from a California number, I have no doubt. Like, I heard you said this. All right, the show can be found at CinemaPod. I'm at GraysonMaxwell1. Tweet us if you have any thoughts on War for Planet of the Apes, or if you hated it, tell us why. I'm very interested to hear. I do not often go on. I call it the other side of the fence because I'm not very often on the good side, like the I love the movie side of the fence. But I mean, if for some reason you don't like the movie, I certainly want to hear about it. Other viewers would like to know why you didn't like it. It's, I mean, this is all subjective anyway, so it's interesting just to talk, chat. So, Nick, you have any last words you want to say?
I can't think of anything.
What do you tweet, Nick? Like, what can people expect to find on your Twitter feed? Like,
oh, everything. I tweet about movies, you know, everything. My thoughts, you know, all my tweets are my thoughts, you know.
There we go.
Just depends on how I'm feeling that day.
Nick tweets all of his thoughts all the time.
You got it.
If Nick eats a bad ear of corn, you're going to hear about it. All right, thanks very much for listening, and this has been another For the Love of Cinema.